Trapped in History, Kenya, Mau Mau and Me, tells the story of how the British colonised Kenya and how the African nationalism arose, and this also describing the terrifying first attacks by the guerrilla freedom fighters known as the Mau Mau. It is the book by Nicholas Rankin. Delighted to say that Nick joins us live on the line now. Good morning to you, Nick.
Good morning, or buenos dias.
Well, yes, and you know a little bit about this part of the world, don't you? Because I'm sitting in a studio literally 30 minutes from The Rock, from Gibraltar. You've written on that. And also, of course, Guernica. You've written about Guernica and the Basque Country as well.
Well, this book really sort of springs out of the last book, Defending the Rock. That book ended with the Falklands War of 1982, the Falklands-Malvinas War, and Gibraltar's role in it, one of which was to turn the cruise ship Uganda into a hospital ship. Now, I wrote about that and I said, well, I know that ship because in 1954, we went on that ship from London to Mombasa, East Africa. And I said, but that is another story. And so this other story is this book, which tells really of my childhood. I went there age 3, came back at 13. So there were sort of 9 years roughly of my life was in East Africa during what was called the emergency, which was this, as you've mentioned, the Mau Mau uprising.
And it's an interesting period of time. Obviously, presumably, you didn't strike out 3-year-olds on your own to go to East Africa. So you went with your parents. You're an independent sort of fellow. What were your parents doing out there?
Okay, the title's called Trapped in History because, in a way, as you grow older, you suddenly discover that your past is history. In the early 1950s, the British Empire still existed. Okay. It's forgotten now. The young don't know anything about it. Basically, after the Second World War, a process of decolonization happened. But in the early 50s, there were many places on the globe that were still pink on the map, not just Canada and Australia and everywhere, but places. There were several places in Africa, from Nigeria, the West Africa, and East Africa. Now, my father, the book begins with a gunshot. Essentially, what happened is a man put his hand in his pocket to get his car keys out, and as he pulled them out, they snagged the trigger of the pistol he had in his pocket. He shot himself fatally in the stomach, and my father got his job. So an accident began, and my father became the general manager of Buchanan's Kenya Estates. He was a businessman. I mean, there were lots of people who had gone out there. There were administrators, there were farmers, there were, you know, when you colonize a country, lots of people go out, including business people. But essentially what had happened was by the 1950s, Kenya became a colony in 1920, having been sort of basically explored in the 1890s. It was very new. By 1950, you had, how shall I describe this? Essentially a pyramid of dominance, on top of which you had 50,000 Europeans, white people. Then you had about 200,000 Asians, brown people from India, who'd come with the railroads and all kinds of things. And then 5 million Africans, black people. How can you have a pyramid like this when the world is changing? It's like a volcano shape, and eventually the volcano will explode. 50,000 cannot rule 5 million.
But the thing is, of course, it had always been like that. This is what the empire was founded on.
It wasn't always like that. Let's say the empire didn't exist always. The empire has a history, okay? And this is what Trapped in History is about. You really can't escape it. I had a friend who wrote to me and he said, look, when you read the first 200 pages of this book, which tells the story of the scramble for Africa, the Christian missionaries and all the rest of it, he said, the rest of it is inevitable because once this situation is set up, look, the British Empire was not alone. The whole of Africa from the 1870s onwards was colonized by, I mean, first the Dutch had been there and the English had been there early, but the Spanish, the French, the Italians, the Germans, the Belgians, the whole of Africa was divided up into, was conquered and taken over. And so what you happen has in the 50s and the 60s is the dissolution of these empires, the revolutions that overthrew them, and Africa moving towards independence.
Can we make the point, then, Nick, that perhaps again, am I looking back with rose-colored binoculars at this point? Because you can say, oh, yes, well, the British, after the Second World War, and, you know, obviously African forces had an awful lot to play. A lot of the empire had a crucial role, the Duke forces. And part of the, if you like, the covenant was that they would get independence after the war. Okay. And so we can look back, as we tend to do, with this sort of strange pride that we let the African nations, as opposed to the, and apologies to our Gallic listeners, the French, and De Gaulle was absolutely going to keep hold of his North African possessions, if not take a few more in Lebanon, Syria, etc.
Well, that is certainly true. There are various views of what the empire was going to be. For the French, it was a mission civilisatrice. They were going to civilize people. The British idea was also spread Christianity and civilization. Part of the reason why David Livingstone and people in East Africa, they wanted to stop the slave trade. Not the Atlantic slave trade, but the Islamic, the Arab slave trade up the East Coast. Slavery was going on, and they went in there to stop it. So it begins with noble ideals, and it ends up with a lot of other things. But it is true that we went out there in 1954. The year we arrived, the uprising had started 2 years before in Kenya. But that autumn, Algeria erupted, a bloody war for the French. And then the Portuguese had their wars. The Spanish had their wars. All of these things, the decolonization process, this was the arc of history. Africa was going to be free somehow. Now, there could have been a constitutional way to do it, but the trouble was the system didn't have enough fissures and vents to let this out. So what you had was the hotheads, the young ones, the radicals, the more violent ones and disaffected ones started killing other people to get their way. This is an armed uprising, and people do terrible things in such struggles.
So the Mau Mau, tell us a little bit about who they were, what they were. I mean, I remember, you know, I'm a schoolboy of the 70s. I remember at my prep school reading about these horrendous terrorists, because obviously, you know, nice English prep school with blazers and caps and the whole thing and shorts. But, you know, there were these terrorists who were basically, you know, killing white farmers, et cetera, et cetera. And these were the Mau Mau.
The Mau Mau, I suppose you could see it originally as a kind of a secret society, an association of largely Kikuyu, but also Meru and Embu and other African people who joined together. They took oaths, and the word Mau Mau wasn't really used by them, but it may derive from the word Muma, which means an oath. Now, swearing an oath is you go through a ritual, an initiation ritual, in order to join. And you're joining with one purpose, is to get your land back and get rid of the exploiters, the white people there. Now, you can either do this constitutionally or you can do it with the panga, the weapons. Now, the way that the British would see this, of course, was they were identified as terrorists. Now, maybe to an outsider, they would say a freedom fighter or a guerrilla. Now, some of them went to the forest and they became Itungati, the fighters there, and they called themselves the Kenya Land Freedom Army. But the way the British propaganda worked was Mau Mau was frightening, satanic, bestial. So you demonize your enemy. And this has always happened in war. Okay, every war, you can look at it the way people looked at the Japanese or the Germans or whoever, all through history, you make your enemy less than human or worse than human in some way. So there was this these armed guerrillas in the forest, and there were people who, they did murder people, and they murdered them horribly. Not many white people died, about 52 or 53 were murdered, but many Africans were murdered. Well, what you have to understand, too, is this is also a civil war within African cultures and tribes. And so most of the Mau Mau that were killed by other Africans, and they killed other Africans.
But this is the thing, isn't it? Especially with Africa, you've put borders where there shouldn't be. You've cut tribes up, and you, with a broad stroke, you don't understand because you are better than them because you're a European. You completely don't get the nuances, and so again, the only thing that we read about is you know, nice white people coming back from cocktail parties in Happy Valley, and that's another story that needs to be written, I suppose. And then being shot, you know, and the women folk being disturbed.
Well, look, Charles, the point is what a lot of history, popular history, is a simple version of history. Mm. If you have you know, people talking about the axis of evil, and you simplify into goodies and baddies. The truth of history is that it is always much more complicated than you think. People are divided within themselves. Some of the whites were good people. They were doctors, they were farmers, they were vets, they were good with their people. Others were drunken, horrible, unpleasant, racist people. There's all sorts of people are mixed. It doesn't matter what country, culture you'll come from, you're going to find horrible people and you're going to find nice people. But the point is, when an armed uprising happens, you get, through injustice, perhaps, you get an uprising of violence, and then you have repression of that violence, which could almost be worse. So you have one terrible kind of atrocity, and then as you repress, you lock up loads of people, and then you want to interrogate them, and some brutal people then start torturing those people. And so you end up with a mess. Most warfare is incredibly messy and horrible. We don't see it on television. They don't allow you to see it on television. What it looks like, what mutilation looks like, the smell of it, none of it is ever seen on television. It's sanitized. It's a video game. Warfare is not like that. And colonial warfare or counterinsurgency is particularly horrible because it takes place among civilians. And one of the problems of the British Army was that they often couldn't tell the difference between combatants and civilians.
And you're a small boy at this point. So what are your records?
Well, we grow up with the propaganda of the day. When we believe, you know, there are good people and bad people. My book ends with the first short story I ever wrote. And it's many years ago, 40 years ago or more, I wrote this short story about being a boy in Kenya. And it's written in a child's voice. And so it's... Obviously, I was in my 30s when I wrote it, but it is trying to recreate the sort of attitude, a sort of chatterbox boy describing what's going on around him. And so we grew up, obviously, with one version, the propaganda version. Writing a book, you don't write a book because you know lots of stuff. You write a book because you want to find something out. I didn't know a lot of this stuff. So finding out the history of Jomo Kenyatta, of African nationalism, of, you know, the Koinange family, of the, you know, it's, if you look at the pictures, most of the pictures are of African people. You know, this is trying to be fair to both sides, not just parroting what my parents thought and believed, because you can't do that. The truth and the job of the journalist and the job of the historian is always to look for the truth.
And isn't there also now, and I'm not going to use the W word, even though it's Christmas, I'm not going to say snowflake, but the thing that we can over, people say, oh, we are overcompensating now because you're saying that all colonialism was wrong.
No, I'm not saying that. Yeah. I mean, what is important
I'm putting the point, Nick. I'm not saying that you're saying that, but people
Are
saying,
I agree. You can have, people think that there's, again, as a binary split, that people are either pro the empire and think it was all absolutely marvelous, and then the other lot think it was all absolutely terrible. On the first page, I say that all empire stories are mixed messages. There is cruelty and beauty. There is horror and there is love. There's all kinds of things mixed together. It is never pure. And in my book, I talk about many of the good people who did things in empire. There's a woman there called Marjorie Perham, fascinating, interesting, liberal woman. This is the only woman in the photos, apart from my mother and my sisters and family photos and my nanny and people. But this woman, who from the 1920s could understand the way history was going, and her arguments with Elspeth Huxley, who was defending the settlers, are fascinating letters between them. I've got people like Graham Greene who went out there, these writers who came and see it. I'm a literary person, so I'm always interested in what writers have to say about these circumstances. And I hope the book isn't, you know, it's not a simple piece of propaganda. It's trying to dissect that. It's trying to, as I say, unbuckle my armor. Look at my own involvement or guilt in these matters, or the sense of shame you might feel about it. I mean, there's a story there about some of the things I did at my prep school that I personally did, not other people in, you know, outside. My own behavior as a child. Everybody is capable of unpleasant things. You can't just demonize other people and think we're all virtuous, because if you look in your heart, you know you've done wrong things. If you were to stand up there before St. Peter at the gate and the book of your life is laid out, you're going to find shameful things.
Well, indeed.
You're
going to
find things you feel guilty about. You know, everybody. I don't care what they look like. Even the Archbishop of Canterbury, I'm sure.
Well, and that's another book in itself. Do you think, here's a question just before Christmas. Do you think that your experiences in Kenya set you on the path to wanting to find out both sides of the story, led to the career, led to the brilliant career you've had thus far, Nick?
I think what I was always interested in, and even as a small child, I see this, is I like storytelling. And I talked a lot. My primary school prep, because he would learn a bit more if he stopped talking and things like this. But I was a storyteller. I loved telling stories and tall stories. And I loved when we would be given a test, you know, here's a quote, find it in the Bible, write the story, rewrite these Bible stories. So essentially that's what my whole literary career has been. My career at the BBC too is telling stories, you know, putting together radio documentaries, putting together, you know, talking to people, pulling stuff together. All my books have used lots of voices, lots of sources. They're like mosaics. I pull from many sources to try and tell an interesting story. And I think, yes, it started in Kenya, obviously. And there suddenly I realized before I die, I must tell this story because, you know, most people under 30 have never heard of the Mau Mau. They know nothing about it. It is history. So before I die, I ought to write this story. And so I did. It wasn't, I must say, it wasn't an easy book to write, Giles, okay? It was a very unpleasant you know, it stirred up a lot of fears and memories, and it's not nice, but you've got to deal with it. The British have to look at their history honestly and openly. You've got to acknowledge it. Like the King, when the King went out there in early November, right, with the Queen, and they went to this museum, and they were shown the Hall of Shame and the Hall of Fame, and they were shown the African view of what the Mau Mau movement to independence was. And he met the daughter of Dedan Kimathi, who was the great demon figure of my youth. He planted a tree with Wangari Maathai's daughter. Now, Wangari Maathai is also in my book. I write about the tree planters and those people who were doing good things. So what the King was trying to do, too, was acknowledge. He said, some of these things we did, there is no excuse for. So British detention camps and torture, they weren't the right thing to do. But we've got to acknowledge it. You can't deny it. It happened. People died at Hola Camp.
And by acknowledging it and looking at yourself and looking at everybody's history, that's the way that you move on to reconciliation. And as the Americans say, you bring closure to it. But you see, you can deal with it in an adult way. And so you can say, because we live in a world of a TikTok, a tweet, a social media thing, the immediate gratification. Oh yeah, I'm pro this, therefore you're against that. And therefore, life's not like that, Nick. It's the nuances. It's the shades of grey. We are neither good nor evil. We are some little mezcler in between.
But the title of the book, Trapped in History, comes from a quote by James Baldwin in The Far Next Time. He said, "For these innocent people have no other hope. They are, in effect, still trapped in a history which they do not understand. And until they understand it, they cannot be released from." And that seems to me completely true for the Germans dealing with the Nazis, for the Americans. It was written for the Americans dealing with their legacy of slavery and genocide of the American Indians. And for us in Britain to look at the British Empire, you just have to acknowledge it. You can't be free of this burden until you try to understand it. And so writing a book like this for me was me trying to understand, you know, my peculiar childhood out there.
It's an interesting. I'll leave you with this one, if I may, Nick, because we're in Spain, beautiful weather, great beaches, blue sea. We get a lot of people from South Africa, former people from South Africa, former people from Zimbabwe, though they'll call it Rhodesia, a lot of people from Botswana or whatever living here. And they always say, oh, the problem is, you see, Africa, it's been left now and it's falling apart and it's not like it was. And is that a case of, you know, they're trapped in their history as well to a certain degree, because they're believing in a place like we now believe that the 60s was a time of peace and love or whatever. And actually, if you look at it, if you were coming from Huddersfield, field, it wasn't quite flower power and running through fields of tulips.
This is nostalgia, and this is a sort of self-serving version of history. Every single country in the world, everybody thinks about 25 to 30, 40 years ago was brilliant. Their own childhood, the music was better. Everything was better. The fact is, those times have changed. That world has gone. Everywhere. You can feel nostalgic about it, but there's a price for it. I mean, there's a line in my book. I said, I always used to say I had a happy childhood. I always used to say that. Because that's the easy thing to say. Yeah, it was lovely out there. But when you start to think about it, how come we live on this land out here? Whose land was it? There's a price to be paid. And of course, we can't accept, we can't let go. This is the problem. People think it was marvelous then, which it should still be that way. The world changes. The world is getting hotter. Things are changing. We have to deal with it. You have to adapt or die.
The book is called Trapped in History, Kenya, Mau Mau and Me. It's by Nicholas Rankin, who is speaking today. Nick, if people want to find you online, I know we just lambasted X or Twitter or whatever you want to call it, but where can people find you if they want to find you on the web or on the socials?
Okay, at Rankin Nick on Twitter. I'm on X or Twitter. That's where I am. And then there's stuff goes there, and you can find me through Faber Books. Faber are my publisher. I've done 6 books with them, including Defending the Rock. Have a look there, and just look for me online. Look for Nicholas Rankin online. You'll find the reviews of this book. Find reviews. You'll find them online. It's been well received so far, and I hope people read it. And somebody said to me, is it enjoy the right word? Because there's horrible things in it. But I think if you're interested and you keep reading, you'll enjoy it.
And the book will also be available as a virtual download from our own virtual bookstore. Have you done the audio book, Nick? Is there an audio book
yet? I did the last one. I did the Gibraltar book. I want to do it again. But you can buy it as a Kindle. You can buy it as an e-book or whatever, any kind of e-book. And you can buy the hardback, and it'll be a paperback next year. But yeah, I hope so. If they take it, I'd love to read it. I think a lot of people like to listen to books.
Absolutely.
So I would urge you to listen to my version of Defending the Rock, not the other guy who did some of the earlier books.
Let's keep with the Christmas spirit. The book is called Trapped in History. It's by Nicholas Rankin. Nick, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Great, Charles. Thanks a lot.